They briefed the fisherman on its plan to dig 12 wells in the plant compound. Groundwater would be pumped from the wells and out to the sea nearby. TEPCO says contaminated water from the crippled reactors has increased 400 tons per day, and that to reduce this, it needs to lessen the amount of groundwater seeping into the reactor buildings. The utility says the plan will cut the daily volume of contaminated water by 100 tons. It also says groundwater radiation levels are now as low as those in nearby rivers. But the fishermen say some of their colleagues are worried because they can't tell the difference between groundwater and contaminated water. TEPCO says it will revisit the plan next month or a later
time. Welcome to Jesus' land, where we all love thy neighbor if thy neighbors understand. We won't let too many Mexicans across the Rio Grande. Welcome to Jesus' land.
And hello. If you've just joined us, please stay tuned for our regularly scheduled program of Indigenous Talk Radio with the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
To choose because they're both pro-life and execution, well, that's another thing. George goes to church where he'll sing from his hymnal, 'cause Jesus once protected him from harm. But if you're a convicted death row criminal, he's been known to stick a needle in your arm. Welcome to Jesus' land, where that Moses guy says, try to pry this rifle from my hand. The Prince of Peace don't want my AK-47 to be banned. Welcome to Jesus' land. Rush Limbaugh is the people's voice. We sure like to listen. He's a moral and a real straight-talking guy, who says crack-smoking addicts should all go straight to prison. We don't care that when he said it, he was high. O'Reilly is another moral beacon. That married man got no spin in his zone. He's always right, politically speaking, once he's finished talking dirty on the phone.
Shut up!
Welcome to Jesus' land, where we see the Lord in every Walmart, Sears, and Disneyland. And where some may turn the other cheek, we draw lines.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Find us on the web. ANG-newswire.blogspot.com.
Oh, yeah. Good.
Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah.
Such a sweet little guy.
Yeah.
All right, well, you're blessed. Yeah. Brian, your husband, is blessed.
Brian.
Anders is
Brian.
Blessed.
Brian. He's Brian.
Yeah, Brian. You like Brian, huh? That's your dad. But we're happy you're here. You guys did a great job.
Yeah.
And I guess you got to thank the Lord, right?
Yeah.
Do you thank the Lord for that split-second decision?
I'm actually an atheist.
Oh, you are. All right. Don't take but you made the right call.
Yeah. Yep. We are here, and you know, I don't blame anybody for thanking the Lord.
Of course not. So. Hey. All right. Anders, want to try one more time?
Angry Indian Radio. You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Real talk for the fourth world.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Who are you? You don't know. Don't tell me Negro, that's nothing. What were you before the white man named you a Negro? And where were you? And what did you have? What was yours? And how did he take it? What gun did you see? Where is your history? How did the man wipe out your history? How did the man, what did the man do to make you as dumb as you are right now?
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
All Indians all over the land, all saying the same thing. This is our homeland. This is our birthright. They don't want any white man comes in here and tell us that you have to divide this up this way or that way. White man doesn't own this land. Just because he has a gun, he said, I took your land.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Transmitting from within the occupied Aboriginal territories of North America to the people of the Fourth World and all ships at sea. This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Internet Radio for Smart Aboriginal.
Este es Aborigen Inteligente de Radio.
This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Ken, who says, why do amazing miracles, like people being raised from the dead, blind eyes opened, lame people walking, happen with great frequency in places like Africa and not here in the United States? What can we do to encourage those things to happen here? Is America too far gone for miracles like this?
Those people overseas didn't go to Ivy League school.
Quite that simple.
Well, we're so sophisticated. We think we've got everything figured out. We know about evolution. We know about Darwin. We know about all these things that says God isn't real. We know about all this stuff. And if we've been in many schools, the more advanced schools, we have been inundated with skepticism and secularism. And overseas, they're simple, humble. You tell them God loves them, and they say, okay, he loves me. And you say, God will do miracles, and they say, okay, we believe him. And that's what God's looking for. That's why they have miracles.
Yeah. Este es Aborigen Inteligente de Radio.
You are listening to the Angry Indian Non-Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Transmitting to the people of the Fourth World from within occupied North America, this is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Salutan and peace to all original human beings resident on the physical plane. I'm your host, Angry Indian, editor-in-chief of the Aboriginal Press News Service, blogging to the Fourth World from aboriginalpressnews.tumblr.com and aboriginalpress.wordpress.com. and angnewswire.blogspot.com. Thank you for tuning in to Indigenous News, thought, and analyses concerning the issues that matter to original peoples and other communities across the world living under imperial, theological, racist, neoclassist, neocolonialist, neoliberal, neo-fascist, and neo-misogynist control. I wish to welcome you all to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Welcome along, welcome along. I wish peace to the gods and earths and love and solidarity to the entire original family at this time of strife and struggle. This is the Angry Indian, and you are in a space of indigenous talk, indigenous thought, ramblings, rants, if you want. You know, you can call it what you want. You know, it is what it is. I'm here, you're here. We're here with our executive producer, who is handling the controls, Guadalupe Morales, and we both, and our families for that matter, want to send out, you know, our best wishes to, you know, the people of Oklahoma, but, you know, especially the indigenous people of Oklahoma, who always get less than the other people of Oklahoma, and, you know, I'm not even going to talk about the whole black Indian thing today. Someone on Twitter sent us, or sent me actually, a heads up that there's a new lawsuit, or at least it was reported on Salon.com today, that there's a new lawsuit of African Cherokee who are going to Oklahoma, you know, they're going to take the main nation to court. Now, for those of you who aren't aware, the official, and we're going to get back to the tornado damage in a second, but the Cherokee Nation is fractured, you know, and it's been fractured. It's been fractured ever since, you know, contact with Europeans. But, you know, what we're going to, you know, what I just want to point out here, because we are going to get into this, and the reason I'm going into this now, excuse me, I'm supposed to go right into the tornado information, is because you already know what's going on with the tornado information. I mean, MSNBC, CNN, C-SPAN, Al Jazeera, you know, I mean, everybody, Press TV, I assume, you know, everybody's looking at this. Everybody's looking at this. And it's as tragic as can be. And, you know, it is what it is. I mean, you know, I seriously feel bad for the people who are living through that. But there's really nothing that I don't have any, you know, information. And there's really nothing I can say, you know, other than, you know, what we're looking at is a direct response of climate change. It's a direct response. And I shouldn't even call it climate change, because that's what Fred Luntz, the propagandist for the GOP, you know, that's his terminology. Why don't we call it what we were calling it in the beginning? Global warming, especially since now that the carbon temperatures or the heating of the planet is now at the same level as it was when the dinosaurs disappeared. So you know what that means, don't you? The party's over. It's fucking over. And you know, and what's capitalism doing? Well, they're growing meat. Yeah, was it the Independent, Lupe, we saw the independent.co.uk. Yeah. You know, they're growing meat now. Bioengineered meat that is actually grown in a lab. And they're going to be serving it in London. So if you're game, if you've seen Soil and Green and you still want to go on, well, you know, tell me about it. Aboriginal Radio at lavabit.com. You know, tell us about it, because I'm pretty curious about this. But yeah, you know, does they need, what do you think, that none of that this stuff isn't connected? Of course it's connected. Everything I just said has a straight line. You just have to look at it. You know what we experienced here as people who reside in the lower 48. You know what we've experienced here is a kick in the ass for Mother Nature. Gaia, whatever you want to do, you know. You know, Mama has had it. She's through. She's tired of the nonsense. She's completely, you know, she's fed up. She's fed up with the violence. She's fed up with the war. She's fed up with the abuse of women, with the abuse of young people. Homosexuals being pulled out of crowds and just, you know, I mean, what just happened here in New York? And then we understand if the reports are true, he laughed about it. He's probably still laughing about it. I mean, they seem to have quite a few people who are being sent up the river over there who, you know, can't stand gay people to the point where they can't control their violence. So what happens? They send them up to where, I mean, an environment that just encourages homosexual sexual activity. You know, I mean, we can make an argument about, you know, what a homosexual is and what homosexuality is supposed to refer to. You know, Gore Vidal was pretty clear on this. You know, you boink who you like, right? You know, I mean, really, especially when we think, you know, in my own personal experience, you know, growing up, everybody that I ever knew who, you know, faggot came out of their mouth every 5 minutes, every 5 seconds, you know, you're a faggot. Oh, that's faggotry. Oh, I don't want to do that faggot shit. Ah, blah, blah, blah. Faggot this, faggot that. Do you know every one of those motherfuckers turned out to be gay? And I'm not talking about homosexual. I'm not talking about a male who happens to like other males. I'm talking about gay. You know, and even then, I mean, the term gay comes from what? Yeah, I know, we're talking about Oklahoma, but I'm going to get back to that. The term gay came from the Victorian age in Britain. You know, the people running around Hyde Park that used to sketch you and then stand on the soapboxes and so on. I mean, the Bohemians. That's what they referred to as gay. You know, and then it, somewhere, I don't know, sometime after that, but between then and now, it just got narrowed down as a pejorative for homosexual males. You know, gay girls, and I know not too many young women remember this or were probably told this. You know, in my case, I was, you know, told this as a youngster by gay members of my own family. You know, back in the day, you know, lesbian, you know, the terminology was different, right? They were arguing to be called gay girls just so they could be recognized. Because, you know, women were not, you know, they were seen and not heard, right? They were harassed and not heard. You know, they were taken advantage of and never heard, really, for the most part. You know, for the most part, you know, because there's been twists in history where, you know, women have actually caused quite a bit of damage. Not necessarily because they had political power, but because of the personal power they had over a particular political individual or a particular political situation in which maybe a woman was a pawn. I mean, you can go into your classical Greek and Roman stuff and find your parables. But, you know, Evita Peron, you know, probably typifies just the easiest example I think I can pull off the top of my head. I mean, here's a fascist. I mean, she was much more fascist than her husband, Juan, was, I feel. She was much more fascist than he was. You know, I'm of the school of thought that he pretty much did whatever the hell she told him to. You know, I'm not saying that he was a weak man, but, you know, he was somebody who he really worked closely with his wife. You know, everything that Bill and Hillary Clinton were teased for, and they was this, you know, gawking and all blubbery about when it came to Ronald Reagan and Nancy. You know, I mean, come on, he ran. That's a better example, actually. The hell with Evita. She was a Nazi supporter. Well, hell, what the hell am I talking about? So were the Reagans. What am I talking about here? But anyway, you know, Nancy Reagan had Ron here, dear old Ron. You know, he was using numerology to set meetings with world leaders and to fix, issues with the economy. She was consulting psychics to suggest to him what to say in cabinet meetings and in speeches. And what colors to wear, and what colors she should wear. Come on. Oh, Kristen Ronnie. Yeah, Ronald Reagan believed in astrology and numerology and psychic reading and past lives. Isn't that what they said about him? Past lives, right? So, so what does this have to do with Oklahoma? Well, the stuff about Ronald Reagan and his astrology thing, indirectly, if he was making decisions based on astrology and numerology, I mean, from what I understand, Henry Wallace under FDR, he believed in it, but he didn't actually put it into play. Or did he, when he had the Great Seal changed, or the dollar bill changed, or what have you, whatever it is. You know, so it's all pretty goddamn insane. But, you know, if he was using that sort of pseudoscience to deal with economic and farming policy, because it was under Reagan, if I remember correctly, that the farms started to disappear because he started trying to hand them all off to the big corporations, which he did. And then when his vice president became president, Monsanto, they were allowed to pretty much do whatever the hell they wanted to do, right? Or was that when Bush was under Reagan, when he was the vice, or what have you. I know that there's a, you know, they had contact with Monsanto. Monsanto was lobbying them hard. There's even video of Pappy walking through a Monsanto plant being given a tour. So, you know, come on. So, you know, we have Monsanto doing the damage. Oh, well, Monsanto doesn't cause tornadoes. That's right. Monsanto, their products do not have a direct effect on tornadoes. That's right. You're right. That's true. But the other, businesses and the other things that Monsanto does has a direct effect on the environment. So because the environment now has damaged agriculture in the United States and Canada for that matter, and it's happening in Mexico too, they just don't tell you about it. Because there's no EPA rules there at all. There's no environmental rules. There's no labor rules. There's no business rules. You pay off somebody and then you can do whatever the hell you want and get your money laundered over there through an American bank or the subsid over there in Mexico, right? So yeah, Monsanto. So while Monsanto has led to the damage of agriculture to the point now where we have to grow meat in a lab that's going to be tested in the UK sometime next week, this tornado that came through from corporations, due to the damage of corporations like Monsanto, like BP, because they don't call it British Petroleum any longer, because they don't want it associated with the British government and the British people, so they just call it BP now. It stands for something else now. Like Blackwater, Z, Academi, and then, as they get more bad press and things get more out of hand, they'll change it again. But you understand where I'm going with this. Walmart is included in this too. Did Walmart create the tornado? No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying the capitalist meme that we're all dealing with. The hegemony in terms of, the amount of damage that these companies and the men who run these companies and the women who work in front for these companies, like the woman who fronts for Yahoo buying Tumblr so that they can put ads all over the goddamn place. They're like they're doing Tumblr a favor, like they're doing the people who use Tumblr a favor. They're not. They're doing themselves a goddamn favor, and they're going to take all of that information they collect, and they're going to sell it to whoever the hell they want to. And they'll give it to whoever the hell has a tie and just ask for it without speaking to a magistrate. This is the way things are. So why are we surprised that a tornado, especially in a country that believes in, Jehovah so much, that believes in, like the finger of God doing damage to the wicked? Because if you notice, Pat Robertson, none of these religious freaks so far have blamed, God yet. They're calling it an act of God, but nobody's blaming, Jehovah, Jesus, any of the Trinity, right? They're not blaming that now, and usually what, they blame gays, they blame feminists, they blame black people, they blame everybody. They blame everything except themselves and except their own memes. They don't take responsibility for what they do. In the meantime, like juveniles, they point to other people.
Well, if you say that I'm bad, then I'm gonna get this bad too.
Now, did that sound juvenile? Yeah, it did, because that's the way they sound to me. I got into it just before all this happened, and back to Oklahoma again, right? Both of these people being ridiculously racist because I pointed out a church, the Landover Baptist Church. Now, if you follow me on Twitter, you might have seen this already. These jerks believed a satire. Well, it was an onion-like story. If I say satire, what is that? An onion-like story. Do you understand that? On John Stewart, do you understand that? If I said it was like a Colbert story, I guess they would have gotten it. But I didn't say satire. Well, I think I said a humor website on the original post. So anyway, the Landover Baptist Church has a forum, and they took a story from, I can't remember the name of the site because I don't frequent websites like this, pointing out the new NRA president who talked about the war of Northern aggression, which he did actually say. He's a Confederate. He's a neo-Confederate. You know, which means what? As far as I'm concerned, he's a traitor, because what did they do? They stood up against the government here, right? They tried to secede. Well, they did secede from the rest of the United States. So they're traitors. I'm saying that as a black man with indigenous blood. They're traitors. They're traitors. They're talking treason, and I don't understand why they're not, you know, if they accuse everybody else anyway who doesn't agree with them, but they're not holding themselves, and they're not being held to account for what they say, which is hypocrisy on top of hypocrisy. But this is the United States, this is the rest of the world, and you know, and that's probably not even true, because they lie in Asia, they lie in South America. They lie in the Arab world, they lie in the white world, they lie in the black world, and I suppose that's why I'm going on a bunch of tangents. It's just because of the feedback I've been getting recently from a lot of people. So like I was saying, you know, Oklahoma, right? So I don't know if they would, because, you know, it was just hard to get them to answer a direct question, you know, because all they can do is insult you. And then if they can't do anything else, then they demand to know whether or not you have an AKC pedigree card. And the female, I guess she was a female, I guess this was a couple I was going back and forth with, because that's what it seemed like, in tandem. You know, two NRA members who took offense that I took offense to the racism found over at the Landover Baptist Church. And then to make things worse, totally misread the post. Because they don't understand, you know, conservatives, I don't give a damn if they're white or Native American or African or Asian. They have, you know, or Spanish-speaking, you know, indigenous person from South or the Rio Bravo or Rio Grande, depending on who you ask. You know, people hate to be, you know, found wrong. They just hate to admit that they don't know what the fuck they're talking about. And then when they get found out that they're completely ignorant, and then, you know, they just realize, oh shit, he just realized that, you know, I got that wrong. Oh, he just realized this. And then he started to get insulted. And then he started to get personal. And they refuse to answer any direct questions. They never stay on facts. And, you know, they want to know what race you are. And then they put it down. And, you know, I was accused of smoking crack. And then I was accused of being gay. And, you know, it just went, you know, on and on and on. So, you know, all because, as far as they were concerned, the NRA president was right to say that the war of Northern aggression, as he put it, was, you know, oppression against the South, and that the anti-black, the nigger jokes, the Trayvon Martin reference, you know, all of the insulting, this totally insulting anti-black things, anti-African things, to be more accurate. Things that were said on the Landover Baptist Church website forums. Go look at them. Right? You know, the whole, whatever his name is, I can't even remember the new NRA president. Whatever his name is, the neo-Confederate that's running at the National Rifle Association right now. They reported this satirical site. I'm sorry I'm jumping around like this, but, you know, this is the way it, you know, I'm dealing with this in terms of the mentality of the people who call themselves conservatives, Republicans, Christians, what have you, you know, trying to decipher and make sense of what they're saying is extremely frustrating. I'm getting a headache right now between my temples trying to, how do you articulate such goddamn stupidity? Okay, look, what it comes down to is some website posted this fool from the NRA, a quote, right? There really wasn't a quote. That it's just a matter of time before we own blacks again, and everybody knows it, or something to that effect. Now, I made a point of linking and posting a snippet from about.com, not some spoof website, about.com, that says that the site that this article, this original article was placed in, is a satire site. It's like The Onion. I mean, there's a few of them out there. The only reason most people know about The Onion is because, well, they have a podcast. At least that's when I was, what? How long ago was that, Lupe, that The Onion started? But anyway, they had a podcast pretty early on. And they started selling advertising space on the podcast. So that's how a lot of people know about The Onion. But, you know, there's other satire sites out there. But in any case, it's right at the bottom of this thing, right at ang-newswire.blogspot.com, the main site for the Aboriginal News Group. our collective newswire. It says right there, from about.com, with a clipping from the site about this particular article, that it is a humor website. It didn't say satire. It said a humor website. So evidently, these two conservative, if they really were Cherokee, because, and like I said, you know, who the hell isn't goddamn Cherokee in the United States, right? You know, that is the one nation that everybody wants to claim. And I don't know what the fuck for. You know, they owned slaves. They turned in and went against other native people on behalf of white people, right? Up until Jackson decided, well, you know what? We want everything that you have, and I don't feel like dealing with you no goddamn more. So you're going to move. And let me point out here, too, that they took their slaves with them, right? We carried the motherfucking bags. And if you really want to believe that they didn't sexually abuse and assault and completely commandeer their female African slaves, then you're a motherfucking fool. You're a motherfucking fool. All right? You know, and like I said, you know, it's not the native thing, but if you really want to get down to history, you know, I mean, this is a nation now. And they're not the first, because the Pequods had gone through this, where you got the white Pequods and the black Pequods, right? The Seminole, which was founded by Gullah people and runaway goddamn, you know, I don't want to say runaway, but, you know, Indians that refused to fucking, you know, just lay down and die, right? You know, and they ran to Florida and continued their war against the Spanish. So it's like, you know, what the hell? And they decided, you know, one fine day to kick out all of their African members, claiming, well, we only want the Indian people here. So, you know, if you got white blood, you can be Indian, right? If you got black blood, then you're quote-unquote black Indian, which is why I never accept that black Indian bullshit. You know, Afro-Indio, you know, Afro, you know, points to Africa. Indigenous points to my indigenous blood in Africa and here. I know where I come from. I'm Gullah Geechee, motherfucker. I know where I come from in West Africa. You know what I'm saying? And I understand the traditions, you dig? And I speak the language, you dig? So it's like, you know, what the fuck? So then you got the Cherokee who take their slaves with them as their property, not as equal members of the nation, as their property. And when they got to Oklahoma, I mean, you know, what happened? And then when the Civil War came down, what, you know, what happened? What happened with that? Whatever Cherokee default for you too, well, hell, there's white people that fight for us too. Does that mean that white society is now absolved from their racism? Does that mean then that the Cherokee Nation or the Creek and what have you, all the five supposedly civilized tribes, basically the fucking sellouts, you know, because they, you know, that they were voices that were standing up for our human rights and our rights within the nation as human beings? Of course they were. Does that absolve Native people, at, you know, broadly because of this? Absolutely motherfucking not. Look, I was in Montana several years ago and got called a monkey. You know, it wasn't that goddamn long ago. And those of you who are African who, you know, bothered to go on that goddamn powwow trail, which has nothing to do with the powwows that I heard about before the, you know, during the 1930s and 40s, where, you know, basically that's when we got together to take care of business. Yes, we danced. Yes, we sang. Yeah, you know, we ate and what have you. But we went to do business. Somehow around the mid, you know, 50s, early 60s, it just became a, you know, a sideshow. So, you know, that's what it is. You know, I mean, how many vendors, you know, go, you know, they step on each other, you know, like the, you know, just like linebackers, just run each other down, you know, so that they can, you know, get their table at these events. So it's like, nah, man, you know, let's just, you know, get serious. You know, what does all this have to do with Oklahoma? Well, that stuff in particular doesn't have anything to do with Oklahoma. I said I'd mention it the next show. I decided to talk about it this show because it was on my mind and because Salon.com's going to argue about it today. All right. So, yes, the Cherokee Nation is centered in Oklahoma. All right. Because that's where they were pushed. All right. The Trail of Tears, the Death March, that's where they were pushed. And then when oil was found on that goddamn flat land, they took that from them, right? So, you know, it is what it is. Started flooding in a whole bunch of Irish and Germans, and then, you know, came up with one roll, and then two roll, and then three roll, and then four roll, and then five rolls, and said, you know what, we're tired. We got, you know, my arm is tired, and we're out of goddamn ink. So, that's it. No more rolls. If you're on the list, you're down. If you're not on the list, I know you're brown. But, you know, too bad. or you weren't here when we decided to line up everybody. Or we got some of your family members, we didn't get the others, so they got absolutely no allotments. But your sister who married that white guy, well, he gets every goddamn thing. So, you know, that's what's going on in Oklahoma in terms of Indian country and African people. Now, as far as the tornadoes, I'm going to go back to what I was saying about Monsanto and the Koch brothers and all the other, multinational, major, you know, evil vulture capitalists in this country who don't give a damn about their fellow countrymen, don't give a damn about the planet. They don't even give a damn about their own families, their own descendants, doing this. I guess they figured out this, I don't know, man, like Logan's Run, live under a goddamn dome someplace while the rest of us are doing THX, living underneath. Well, hey, I'm the brother that stepped off the hologram, if you saw that film. And, what happened in Oklahoma is a direct result of what capitalism, what Americanism, what this system, this meme of just do it all, do whatever you want, and it just totally use the earth and everything in it until it's completely gone. Just run it until it completely breaks, right? You got a privatized prison system in the United States. They're doing the same thing in the UK and Australia. They got private joints now in Aotearoa, in New Zealand, right? Okay. Scotland, right? Okay. Now, how are they supposed to stay in the business? How are they supposed to stay in the business? If the crime goes down with all of these, biometric scanning, drones, right? All of these waves now to see if you have a weapon on you, all kinds of... what do you call these things, Lupe? Whatever this radiation that they use on these various scanners. Just like what you see in sci-fi, like the Total Recall, right? Okay, so we got all that. So if the crime is non-existent, then who the hell is in the private prisons? The only way they can make money is if they're warehousing people. The only way that they can make a living is to warehouse human beings. There's nothing else they can do, because they go on the assumption, or at least they make the they make a noise, which is based on a lot of public assumption, a lot of ignorant public assumption. They make a noise, a great noise, about the public service that they do and such and so on, but the bottom line is they're warehousing human beings, and they're getting subsidies to warehouse human beings and tax breaks to warehouse human beings so that they can stay in business. The fact that they're ruining lives doesn't concern them, and it doesn't seem to concern the paid lowlifes that are supposed to be representatives in local legislatures, in the District of Columbia. None of it is logical unless you have a logic and a philosophy that says that it is entirely permissible for human beings to basically feed on other human beings. Because I find very little difference between the private prison industry and a private hog farm. I don't see any difference. And what you're maybe not seeing in terms of what happened in Oklahoma here is we're putting a hell of a lot of effort into putting people in cages and then let them out for a certain amount of time during the day to make things that we use in the street here. I don't know how many of you noticed, 60 Minutes reported that all of the uniforms for the military and almost all of the uniforms that are sold for uniformed police officers and security guards and what have you, even down to many of the equipment, quite a bit of this that's in the United States is made by prison labor. And how much are they getting paid? If they're getting paid. Because they have to pay them legally, because the Constitution says if you don't pay them legally, it's slavery. but then they charge them for their incarceration, so they end up taking the money back. Dig what I'm saying? You know, and again, what this has to do with Oklahoma is, while we're paying attention and creating a meme and reinforcing a meme that has an attitude that is okay to warehouse people, that is okay to invade countries, that is okay if it happens over there, we can do a sequester that isn't necessary, when all you really need to do is to tax the goddamn corporations. We just found out today, Lupe and I, that Apple pays no income tax. Apple. Steve Jobs. Apple pays no income tax. Right? They do what they want. And then when the damage happens, they want to talk about God and say, okay, everybody, let's send some blankets and let's pray for these people. How about preventing these things from happening in the first place? How about preventing black men from losing their minds by treating them like human beings? How about treating, you know, our Spanish-speaking brothers and sisters like human beings in their own countries, so that they don't feel the need to have to risk their lives and to separate themselves from their families to come over to where their money is being siphoned? What I'm saying is the tornado in Oklahoma, well, these things are going to happen, but they're going to happen more often because of the way the state of affairs, the way things are. This is going to happen again and again and again and again and again. And I'm not the only person that's been telling you. This is the Angry Indian, and you've been listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. Head on RadioNetwork.com, an internet-based conversation radio experiment. Available most easily at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. There's a listen live button. Just jump right on it, and there you are. Or if you're on a mobile device, it's also easy to find us at TuneIn Radio, a nice app for your mobile smartphone, or Tuner Internet Radio, or Dar.fm, or Stitcher Radio, Streama.com. We are rather ubiquitous. I mean, if we got more every night, we'd be paying salaries, right? Head on RadioNetwork.com.
Nicely paired. Sachin is off the mark. तुझे फिर से मेरे वॉलेट से पैसे निकाले?
अरे वो नीलम को जरूरत है।
अरे नीलम को मैं कमा के लाऊं और तू नगरी रहती तेरी तो कितनी बार समझा तेरे को? मेरे वॉलेट को हाथ में लगा रहा।
मुझे मत मारो।
और जब देखो तब फालतू चीजों पर पैसे खर्च करती रहती हो। अरे मारे के चेहरे निखो के रखी। इतना ही अगर तेरे को चैरिटी का शौक है तो जा अपने बाप से ले।
घरेलू हिंसा में बाधा डालकर उसे रोको। बेल बजाओ। घरेलू हिंसा अधिनियम पर जानकारी के लिए bellbajao.org पर लॉग ऑन करें। ब्रेक थ्रू की पहल।
Hello, I'm Carol Gordon. Plan B is an emergency contraceptive that prevents pregnancy. It is not an abortion pill and does not cause an abortion, only the prevention of pregnancy. If you have had unprotected sex or have been raped and need Plan B, contact your local Indian Health Service. You have a legal right to receive Plan B over the counter, meaning without a prescription or a doctor's appointment if you are 17 or older. Plan B must be taken within 72 hours of sexual intercourse to be effective. For more information, call 605-487-7072. This message is brought to you by the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center.
I'm Dick Gregory with PETA.
Martin Luther King Jr. taught me the fight against oppression is never an easy one. It's even harder if you have no voice. For animals held captive in circuses, life consists of cramped cages, shackles, and daily beatings. There is no escape. They cannot demand their freedom. Images like these bring only one word to my mind, slavery. Be an abolitionist for the animals. Please don't go to circuses. For more information, contact PETA.
757-622-PETA.
This is Colonel Ann Wright. I resigned from the State Department in protest over the war in Iraq the day the war began. I had served in the State Department for 16 years and for 29 years in the U.S. Army and Army Reserves. The war in Iraq was a war of choice, not a necessity for our national defense. The Bush administration now bombs countries rather than speaking to them. We in the Congress were lied to, and we need an investigation of those lies. Please ask your Congress member to impeach George Bush and Dick Cheney for the lies they have told and the dangerous situation they have placed our country in.
Sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
Every day, one more Aboriginal person will test positive for HIV. Some will be rejected by their family, friends, and community. They will live in isolation, their voices no longer heard. HIV/AIDS stigma and discrimination denies our people the right to protect their future. You can make a difference. Be their voice.
White society wants you to know that anti-African racial hatred is a thing of the past.
And the Democrats are throwing the election away. For what? An inadequate black male? Who would not have been running had it not been a white woman that was running for president. I'm no second-class citizen. And goddamn the Democrat.
With white people showing love like this, who needs enemies? Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. The anti-colonial cure for mental slavery.
Just when you thought it was safe to turn your radio back on.
This is APNS Public Radio.
Hold on a second, not so fast, race does exist. Now there's the old-fashioned view, race does exist because it's biological. So that's called by some people racial naturalism. But the position that most people in critical race theory have is race does exist, but its existence is not a biological existence, it's a socio-political existence. And from this perspective, the reality of race is basically a reality that is socially created. It's not an intrinsic reality in the nature of the human race that there are these sort of natural demarcators, these sort of natural lines of division among the family of humans. Rather, these lines are artificially drawn by human beings, and the argument is they're drawn in response to particular political projects. So the idea is that race then becomes a system, and if we ask a person, what is your race? What we're really asking is, where are you located with respect to the system? It's not a question of, you know, what the person's natural biology or their natural genetic makeup is. That's not really the question. What we're really asking is, how are you located in the system? And the system varies. So you can move from one country to another and you can assume a different race. The system evolves over time. So if you racially categorize one way at a particular time, you could go back 100 years and find you racially categorized a different way. But we should not infer from this that race is therefore unreal. That's a mistaken inference. Race is constructed, therefore it's unreal. It's not a conclusion that follows. Race is constructed, but it's very real. It's very real because being categorized a certain way, being identified as having a certain race, then slots you into a particular position in this racial system. And the extreme example, of course, the clear-cut example is apartheid South Africa. You're categorized as black, you're categorized as colored, you're categorized as white. This is going to have an immense influence on your opportunities, on your life chances, on where you can go, on whom you can marry, on all these things. And as such, it's likely to have an effect on your consciousness also. So the social reality of race should not at all be taken to imply that it's not something that matters. It matters hugely. But we need to locate the proper metaphysics of it. And the proper metaphysics I'm arguing is a social metaphysics, a social ontology, rather than a natural, biological ontology. So you could run thought experiments and, hey, you know, philosophers don't like to get their hands dirty. Physicists, you know, they do real experiments. Chemists, they do real experiments. Biologists. social sciences, you're a sociologist, you're going down to the south side of Chicago, you're researching gangs, you pretend to be a gang member. 5 years later, you write your dissertation, the gang takes out a hit on you. You know, you're an anthropologist, you go to the Australian outback. You know, all these guys, they get their hands dirty. Philosophy, easy. You do a philosophy experiment, it's a thought experiment. So, you know, you just assume the position, which is this. And then half an hour later, or for the really deep, important philosophical insights, 45 minutes later, you come out in that major stuff. You know, I've seen the form of the good, and it looks like this. Or I've seen the inner motive of history, and it's this. And it's a wonderful discipline, and a very cost-effective, you know, hard requires any money. And as I say, coming out with great stuff all the time. So whatever negative remarks I might have made of philosophy in my books or else, you know, it's a wonderful discipline from that point of view. Okay, so you can do a thought experiment. You can imagine a world radically different from our own. You can imagine, if there are any science fiction fans here, you know that a famous sub-theme of the discipline is the parallel universe, okay? So there's a crucial point, and something happens differently. So the Nazis win World War II. That's one favorite. The Nazis win World War II, so you get a Third Reich, which lasts longer than 12 years, and you then have a whole world imagine what would it have been like in that world. Or the South win the Civil War, and so forth. So here's a sort of crucial demarcation point. So it's sometime in the Middle Ages, okay? Something in the Middle Ages, and in Africa, you have some Africans talking, and they have time on their hands, and say, I have an idea, guys. Let's get into a ship and sail up north and discover Europe. And everyone says, yeah, you know, that's a good idea. Let's do that. So they get in the boat, and they sail up, and they link up with the Moors in Spain, with the force of Islam in the East, and they overrun Dark Ages Europe. So you could then have a situation where you have a racial dictatorship established by people of color over white people. And the white people sunk as they are in superstition and barbarism. The white people would then be seen as the savages. People of color would then be seen as the civilized ones. So it means that in a world like that, white people and whiteness and white blood would all be stigmatizing. So it would then mean that under those circumstances, somebody with any white ancestry would then be categorized as white, because white is the stigmatizing blood that rocks you. So it would mean that in that world, I would then be a white guy. So I would then be a white guy, but I wouldn't be a white guy who's riding at the front of the bus or the ox cart, I guess, in medieval times. I'd be riding at the back of the ox cart, and I'd be somebody who does not have privilege, and I'd be somebody seen as a savage. So it means that the same person in front of you, Charles Mills, who's categorized as black in the US, and by the way, my native Jamaica, not categorized as black, was a different color system in Jamaica. So I'm categorized as black in the US, I'm categorized as brown back in Jamaica. In this alternative universe, this alternative Dark Ages Europe overrun by people of color, I would be a white guy. So it's the same person biologically, it's three different social categorizations, and it means corresponding to that, it's three sets of social expectations, social rules, systems of privilege, systems of disadvantage. So that's a huge difference race makes, but it's a difference that's not biologically ontological. It's a difference that's socially ontological. So it's a social ontology rather than a naturalistic ontology. Okay, so my claim is that in talking about race, it's more illuminating to focus on a racial system than racism. I'm not saying we should pay no attention to racism, but I'm saying the racial system is the more important thing. And you could have different racial systems in different universes. In this particular world, in this sort of non-alternative universe, the most important racial system has been white domination of people of color. And that's because of the expansion of Europe and the ideologies that accompany the expansion of Europe and the fact that all over the world, in this country, in the US, in Australia, in colonial Africa, in colonial Asia, white people come to dominate people of color. So these categories of race, of whiteness and non-whiteness, then become the crucial ones. So my argument has been in all my work that we need to focus not just on racism, we need to focus on racial domination. And you can have racial domination without it necessarily being the case that all the whites in that system are racist. This is very important, especially in the US of 2010 with a black president and most whites saying, what are you talking about? Racism, affirmative action, there's a black guy in the White House. There's a black guy in the White House, for God's sake, so how can you still be talking about racism? And the point you have to make to people is that you can have a black guy in the White House and you can still have a system of white domination, please.
You are listening to the Angry Indian and Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Real talk for the fourth world.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith. Welcome, traveler. Can you handle the truth? I didn't think so. Me neither. But it will happen anyway. Science is beginning to prove we have already changed the planet's climate in dangerous ways. A small group of climate scientists, backed by a billionaire and big oil, are considering taking over control of the climate to stave off disaster. Then we'll find proof our current 400 parts per million will melt so much Arctic and Antarctic ice, warming up to 8 degrees C, that global coasts will flood the world's largest cities. We'll wrap up with one of the few positive alternatives growing in this disturbed scene, a wake of bike sharing around the world. It can work. Gather round, boys and girls, as we tell the story of Earthmasters, the men who would take over from nature to run the climate of the world. Or do they mean to save us from our fossil-addicted selves? For all who love a good conspiracy, geoengineering has it all, the oil companies, far-right think tanks, nuclear weapons scientists, and even Bill Gates. But you have to hang in a little bit while we first look at a few small problems in their plans. Our guide is Clive Hamilton. After careers in the Australian Public Service as an economics and resource advisor and several stints at universities like Yale, Cambridge, and Oxford, Hamilton founded and ran a progressive think tank called the Australia Institute. Now he's professor of public ethics in a program run by two Australian universities. You may have heard of books Clive has written or co-written, including Growth Fetish, Affluenza, Silencing Dissent, and more recently, Requiem for a Species, Why We Resist the Truth About Climate Change. But his latest book is Earthmasters, The Dawn of the Age of Climate Engineering. We've reached Clive Hamilton in Canberra. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex.
Well, it's good to connect with you, and I begin maybe a little facetiously by saying your book is full of some great news. It's a real relief. We just have to pump a bit of sea salt into the air and we can go on burning fossil fuels as before, even if we double the CO2 in the atmosphere. What are some scientists proposing to stop global warming? Try and make a little case for them.
Well, the idea of geoengineering has now come onto the international climate change agenda because the climate scientists themselves became very worried at the failure of the world to respond to their warnings. So the argument is that if Plan A, reducing global greenhouse gas emissions, isn't working, shouldn't we have Plan B? And that's where they started to develop these geoengineering ideas, a whole string of technologies that would either suck carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere or to put some kind of solar shield between the Earth and the Sun to cool the planet by basically reducing the amount of sunlight that reaches planet Earth.
Well, it's that latter one I want to talk to you most about, solar radiation management. Who named it that, and did he come up with another name for it?
Well, there's one of the more prominent scientists involved in researching geoengineering, Ken Caldera at Stanford University, came up with the term solar radiation management, although more recently he's decided that perhaps sunlight reflection methods would be a term that would less likely frighten the horses. He came up with that term, he wrote, because talking about geoengineering would be too scary for some bureaucrats, and he was wanted to get some money to hold a seminar at NASA. And he was worried that geoengineering or climate engineering might make them a bit afraid. So he came up with his idea of solar radiation management. But of course, as soon as you think about it, managing the amount of solar radiation which reaches planet Earth, I mean, that's a pretty scary thought. And when you consider the primary method that is being put forward, it becomes scarier. And that method is essentially to surround the entire Earth in the upper atmosphere with a layer of so-called sulfate aerosols, tiny particles, essentially a kind of pollution, same kind of pollution that causes acid rain, but this time way, way up in the stratosphere. And because it's a pollution, these tiny particles would basically, depending on how much you put up there, reduce the amount of incoming solar radiation by perhaps 1 or 2%, thereby cooling the planet.
Isn't that the same as happens when volcanoes go off?
It is, and in fact, the idea for sulfate aerosol spraying as a method of geoengineering was prompted by observations over 100 years or more of the impact on the Earth's climate of major volcanic eruptions. Mount Pinatubo, for example, in 1991 in the Philippines, was a massive eruption, and it put so much volcanic ash and other particles and soot into the atmosphere that once it had circled the globe, it cooled the planet for half a degree or more for a couple of years. So that gave rise to the idea of, well, what if we could control the amount of this kind of sulfate aerosol in the upper atmosphere, say, with a fleet of specially equipped aircraft that would go up on a regular basis and spray the precursor chemicals, sulfur dioxide or sulfuric acid, which would then in the upper atmosphere form sulfate particles and basically put a kind of thin shield around the Earth, which then whoever controlled it could turn up or down to offset the impacts of warming due to carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
Well, right, but then the next point you raise, I believe you used the term spine-chilling, is what happens if we succeed in cooling the planet but then can't manage to keep the program going. You used the year 2059, I believe. What happens?
Well, this is one of a string of fairly frightening possibilities arising from sulfate aerosol spraying. A lot of modelling work has been done using big global climate models, but there has been no testing of it yet. One of the difficulties is that if we did, we, the global community, and, you know, there is a question whether it would be the global community that did it or one power, China or United States maybe, but if we, the global community, decided to do it, we would need to do it for at least 10 years before we had enough data to be able to separate out the effects of sulfate aerosol spraying from the effects of global warming and natural climate variability. But building on that, the whole point about solar radiation management is it's not trying to counter human-induced climate change, but simply to deal with one of the symptoms. Okay, so one of the symptoms of human-induced climate change, and you know, the main one, is a warming globe. And so rather than tackle the source of the problem, that is burning fossil fuels and putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, sulfate aerosol spraying would try to counter one of the impacts of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So basically it's suppressing the warming that's happening. It's countering it by putting this solar shield around the Earth. And so the question is, well, if we had to stop, if we had to take down the solar shield for some reason, maybe there was a really big unintended consequence, like it had a major effect, negative effect on rainfall patterns around the world, or let's say there's a big international conflict about the solar shield and it was stopped. We stopped sending the planes up, we stopped spraying the sulfate aerosols, and within a year or so, all of these sulfur particles fall out of the upper atmosphere. The problem is that we'll then have decades and decades of suppressed warming. Let's say we turned it off in 2060. We'd have decades of suppressed warming as we continue to pump carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, if indeed we did do that. And then there would be a huge rush of this warming that would happen very, very quickly. And as you know, the damage to ecosystems from global warming is due more to the rapidity of warming rather than the amount of warming, because if it's faster warming, ecosystems have less time to adapt. So this whole question is called the termination problem. Could we, once we'd started, could we actually terminate it, or would we be locked into this solar radiation management virtually in perpetuity?
Right, for generations to come. You mentioned rainfall, and you go into some detail in the book Earthmasters about the possibilities of rainfall changing in big ways. Could you talk to us for a minute about that?
Well, one of the big rainfall or precipitation events in the global climate system is, of course, the so-called Indian monsoon, which happens with great regularity each year, and which is obviously crucial to irrigated agriculture over a vast swathe of the Indian subcontinent. And so a billion or more people depend on the Indian monsoon for their food supplies. One of the modelling studies using these global climate models looked at the impact on precipitation around the world of sulfate aerosol spraying and concluded that it's possible that the change to the global weather patterns as a result of sulfate aerosol spraying would be to shift the Indian monsoon, essentially from over India, Pakistan, sort of southwest over more towards Africa. And if that were to happen, of course, there would be a great drought in those regions and potentially severe effects on food supplies. I should say other modelling studies have suggested that that probably won't happen. But the fact that this is a possibility really opens up some very worrying implications and really points to the question of, well, who would control the global climate? And this question of governance, we're not even at that stage of thinking seriously about it yet. But given that global warming is continuing apace, the growth of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere is accelerating, the prospect of engineering the climate is a very real one, and it's time now, and in a way this is why I wrote my book Earthmasters, for the world community to get involved so that if a time does come where it's seriously considered to take control of the Earth's climate, then it's not just the powerful few that have a say, but the world community as a whole.
Yeah, should it be Dick Cheney or perhaps the leader of North Korea? It's pretty hard to decide who in this world is ready to control the climate. Why can't we experiment with this first in some faraway part of the world to see whether the theory works?
For other geoengineering techniques, and I should say that sulfate aerosol spraying is kind of the headline technology, but there are a number of others which are being tested in various ways, less scary ones in some cases. But sulfate aerosol spraying, really, you can't test it because to see what effect it would have on the global weather patterns and certainly on the Earth's temperature, you can't do an experiment. You have to actually do it. You have to do the lot. You have to put up the sulfate aerosol shield and see what happens. So if you just went up over the ocean somewhere and sprayed some sulfuric acid into the upper atmosphere, I mean, it might be very valuable telling you something about the chemistry of the upper atmosphere and where the aerosols do form and in the way anticipated, but you couldn't find out what impact sulfate aerosol spraying would have on the global climate, on warming, on precipitation, on the ozone layer, for example, without actually implementing the scheme as a whole. So if we ever do it, it will be a gamble because we'll never really know with a great degree of confidence how it will work until we've actually done it.
Clive, does that mean we can't do regional climate control? Like, for example, some are advocating we could do it to save the Arctic sea ice.
No, well, some are advocating that. I mean, some serious people are advocating that. Not only are they advocating it, they're saying we should be doing it now. We should be doing it to slow down or prevent the melting of the sea ice in the Arctic. The problem, of course, is that if you go up there in the Arctic high up and spray sulfate aerosols, well, you know, they soon start blowing around the world and dispersing, and so you have to have a continuing program of spraying sulfate aerosols over the Arctic, which protects the Arctic for a while, but you know, very soon, within days or weeks, it gets blown around the world. And so it's very difficult to really isolate a particular area and to concentrate the activity on deflecting solar radiation from a particular part of the world.
This is Radio EcoShock with Clive Hamilton, an Australian intellectual and author of the new book, Earthmasters. I'm Alex Smith, and yes, we are talking about geoengineering to save the world, maybe. Clive, there's an old saying, you can't tell the players without a program. Your book has a pretty good outline of the people and institutions championing man-made climate control. Why not tell us about two of the key movers, Ken Caldera, who you've mentioned, and David Keith? Who are they?
Ken Caldera and David Keith are extremely well-regarded and accomplished climate scientists. Ken Caldera, as I mentioned, is at Stanford, and David Keith is at Harvard, formerly at the University of Calgary for many years. And they are extremely active in the geoengineering research arena, to the point where an earlier author dubbed them the geo-clique. And they are extremely active. They're very concerned about climate change, and which is why they are investigating geoengineering. Although, as I explain in the book, I think both of them have some kind of odd attitudes to global climate change. But one of the reasons why they're so important is that some years ago they became the principal advisors on climate change to Bill Gates. And Bill Gates was so impressed with their intelligence and commitment that he allocated several million dollars to a fund to conduct research into geoengineering technologies. So Caldera and Keith have been administering this fund for research, and it has also led, their influence has led Bill Gates himself to start investing in a number of companies which developing geoengineering technologies. One of them, for example, one of the companies that he's associated with is called Intellectual Ventures. The CEO is a man called Nathan Myhrvold, who was formerly the chief technology officer at Microsoft. Another man associated with Intellectual Ventures is named Lowell Wood. Now, Lowell Wood is an extremely interesting character. He was for many years, decades, until he left fairly recently, one of the gurus of weapons research, nuclear weapons research, at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, one of the two major Cold War weapons research laboratories. Livermore is located outside San Francisco. Lowell Wood was the protege of Edward Teller, the so-called father of the hydrogen bomb and one of the foremost Cold War architects. And so Lowell Wood and Edward Teller were responsible not only for Star Wars, the ill-fated venture for a missile shield, which the US could use space-based missile shield to defend against or indeed attack the Soviet Union during the Cold War, but they also, in the late 1990s, Lowell Wood and Edward Teller wrote one of the very first papers on geoengineering. And so in the book, I investigate the kind of links between geoengineering and Cold War thinking. If you reflect on it a bit, here we have with geoengineering, potentially at least, a vast technological plan to take control of planet Earth. This is in the grander designs. There are much more localized and benign forms of geoengineering to which this kind of analysis doesn't apply. But when it comes to sulfate aerosol spraying, you've got what I call a sort of Promethean vision to use technology to control nature, not just bits of nature, not just ecosystems or a river system or, you know, with a dam or something like that, or to carve out new ports using nuclear explosions, which Edward Teller was very keen to do, but to actually take control using technology of the planet's operating system in its entirety. And so, in a way, this is my main concern, that in some parts of the geoengineering community, there is this Promethean ambition for control. I should say that there are others in the United States, and more particularly in Europe, who take a very different view of geoengineering. Even though they support research into geoengineering, they're far more humble, far more circumspect, far more worried about unintended consequences and the political misuse of geoengineering. So in a way, there's a kind of split within the geoengineering community between those who are very worried, in fact terrified about climate change and think with heavy hearts that we have to investigate Plan B, and others who get very excited about Plan B because they see it as the opportunity for mankind, and I use the word deliberately, to use our unique position, our technological genius, to finally take control of the Earth and subdue it.
Ah, we become the Earth masters. Well, there's others waiting in the wings. I could see how this would really benefit the oil companies. They could keep on selling their products. What multinational oil companies are already involved in the geoengineering scene?
Well, of course, your companies and other fossil fuel companies realize they have to be very careful here because like national governments that could be reducing carbon dioxide emissions but aren't or are only pretending to, the oil companies can be accused of trying to essentially torpedo Plan A, reducing carbon dioxide emissions by promoting this bright, shiny Plan B. Nevertheless, the oil companies have quietly started to take an interest in geoengineering. ExxonMobil, for example, and there's no company or indeed organization in the world that's done more to try to undermine the credibility of climate science and to stop nations, particularly the US, from adopting policies to reduce carbon dioxide emissions. But ExxonMobil has an expert named Haroon Keshki, has an expert in geoengineering who's quietly been participating in task forces which looking at geoengineering and advocating more research. Shell, Royal Dutch Shell, is supporting research into geoengineering technology known as ocean liming. ConocoPhillips is supporting in Africa and elsewhere another geoengineering technology called biochar, a more benign technology compared to sulfate aerosol spraying, much more benign, and a lot of environmentalists support biochar. But the fact that ConocoPhillips is putting quite a lot of money into developing biochar as a kind of plan B for global warming certainly should set some alarm bells ringing.
Even the American Enterprise Institute, which took big oil money to deny climate change for years, has come out in favor of geoengineering, you write, for what? For a problem that doesn't exist? Help me, Clive, my brain is melting trying to make this connect.
It is very bizarre, isn't it? Until you start to think about it more carefully. So here we have these right-wing think tanks like the American Enterprise Institute, which for a decade or more has been actively working to repudiate, undermine, deny climate change science. And whenever any measure, state or national, to reduce carbon dioxide emissions has been put forward, has embarked on a campaign to attack it for all the usual right-wing reasons about government control and environmentalist secret agenda and so on and so forth. And so here you have them, nevertheless, supporting geoengineering. And the reason for it is that geoengineering sort of reverses the whole problem of human-induced climate change. Geoengineering, when it's put forward as a substitute for cutting carbon emissions, promises to turn a drastic failure of the free enterprise system into a triumph of human ingenuity. So instead of climate change being a vindication, a terrible vindication of the warnings of environmentalists, geoengineering exposes the lack of faith of environmentalists in humanity's ability to use its technology to solve these problems. So for organizations like the American Enterprise Institute, geoengineering doesn't represent the danger of technological hubris, but is an expression of human mastery over nature. So you can see how geoengineering, as opposed to reducing carbon dioxide emissions and shifting to renewable energy technologies, represents an affirmation of their view of the world, of humankind, of the free enterprise system. It's a sort of bizarre twist. So here we have these organizations which for years have been vigorously arguing that there is no such thing as human-induced climate change, and then along come these proposals for geoengineering as a response to human-induced climate change. They say, that's the kind of cure to a problem which we previously said didn't exist, but that's the kind of cure we're willing to swallow. So let's have some.
We are talking with author Clive Hamilton about his new book, Earthmasters, and due to time limitations, we won't be going into the technologies to suck carbon dioxide out of the air. People, you're going to have to buy the book to get that. But Clive, I would love to see you write a series of popular articles from this book to get these facts out more widely, or have you already done that?
I've done a few, and they can be found on the internet. I'm also going to be doing a tour in the United States and Canada in the next two or three weeks, and so I imagine more of those kinds of articles will be appearing in easily accessible formats for people.
His website is clivehamilton.com. The book is Earthmasters, The Dawn of the Age of Climate Engineering from Yale University Press. I admit it made me so angry at one point I had to toss it down partway through and go out for a walk. But Clive, you're very patient as you explain some of these kind of crazy things that are going on
behind the scenes. It's gathering a lot of momentum. as the climate science becomes more alarming and we go into a next warming spike, the calls to geoengineer the planet will become public and loud, and we need a really vigorous public debate so that it's not left to the powerful to protect their interests at the expense of everyone else.
Listeners, now it's up to you to spread the word about this and get people educated, because in his book, Clive shows polls that say most people don't even know this is happening, that the debate is even happening, and we need to know more about it. I'm Alex Smith. I highly recommend you follow up with Clive Hamilton's book, Earthmasters. Thank you so much, Clive.
Thanks, Alex.
In the last year, scientists discovered a climate record going back over 3 million years, long beyond the ice core records of 800,000 years. Research led by Professor Julie Brigham Grett from the University of Massachusetts Amherst drastically changes our understanding of the world. Drilling into a lake in the Russian Arctic created from a meteor strike ages ago, she found several periods, where the Arctic was up to 8 degrees warmer than today. That despite carbon dioxide levels thought to be similar to or below today's 400 parts per million. The Greenland ice sheets have repeatedly shrunk to half their current size. The West Antarctic ice sheet completely disappeared 1.1 million years ago. The sea level was tens of meters higher than today. Here is a selection of key clips recorded from a YouTube video presentation by Dr. Julie Brigham Grett at Amherst in the summer of 2012, almost a year ago, and yet hardly anyone has heard of these startling findings.
So everything you see here in this diagram from stage 5 on is absolutely new. No one's ever seen this before in the Arctic in a continuous record from the land. We know from looking at this stage 5 here, 125,000 years ago, the Arctic was a little warmer than now. Globally, we were 1 or 2 degrees warmer than present. The Arctic may have been 2 or 3 or 4 degrees warmer than present. And scientists agree now that the Greenland ice sheet at that time was probably 40 to 50% of its present size. So we can see what the Arctic does in a warmer world. So well, let's look at stage 11 at 410,000 years ago. And if we take this little interval right here and expand it out, this goes from 450,000 to 380,000 years here. So we've blown up stage 11. So let's look at that in terms of the vegetation around there. And on the left, I have color-coded. The red here is just trees and shrubs. When there's lots of trees in the Arctic, you know it's got to be warm. And the cooler intervals here in blue. So this is, again, stage 11. This is the pollen, preservation of the pollen that records the vegetation at the time by Pat Anderson at the University of Washington and Tolya Loshkin in Magadan. Their pollen records then have been transferred into a biome model by Pavel Terezov, which allows us then to reconstruct paleo temperatures. And what this shows is that through the interval of stage 11, the climate was in fact 8 degrees warmer than present in summer. That's astounding. Nobody's ever seen this before. So this was astounding that not only was it warm, it was warmer than 5E when that previous interglacial. This is not what we had expected.
This is Radio EcoShock. In just a minute, we'll return with more from Amherst Professor Julie Brigham Grett as the Arctic reveals secrets of previous ages of extreme warming.